So the teachings this summer and early September are really preparatory for our retreat in October, but they also stand alone, and they're meant to explain some things about Tibetan Buddhist practice, and in particular, open up what we will be doing in October, which is emblematic of Tibetan Buddhist practice, but in kind of bite-sized pieces to just come to appreciate maybe a different approach to spirituality. In a kind of granular way, I think you each spoke to elements of what I think is important in Tibetan Buddhist practice, and I'll probably touch on them as we speak tonight. The practice we'll be doing in October is a revealed treasure. So that itself is a bit mind-blowing if we begin to think about it, because the story goes something like this, that, do the math, some 1,200 years ago, about 800 AD, in Tibet, a teacher comes from India named Padmasambhava, who is depicted in the tanka right above Kuang's head. He's in several other tankas, but that's the central figure in that one, Guru Padmasambhava. He's a central figure in that one as well. So he comes to Tibet to introduce Tibetan Buddhism to Tibet. And he has 25 main disciples and numerous minor disciples. And at that time, he using modern language, deposits spiritual time capsules in the earth, in space, in the water, and in his disciples' minds. And those come to be called treasures. So there are earth treasures, sky treasures, water treasures, and mind treasures. And the way the teachings on the treasures go is that treasures become revealed at an appropriate time. And there's Thukhu Tundup, I think, has a book on treasures and the revelation of treasures. And there's a lot of, it can be a lot of complexity involved, a lot of stages. Sometimes, like a teacher will wake up and they'll have a scroll in their hand that they wake up with, and it'll be in a script that they themselves can't read, and then they've got to find a translator. So the scroll is kind of like a zip drive, and at this point, probably almost everybody in this room has had the experience of getting a zip drive, but not having the code to unpack the zip drive. So you know you got something, but you don't know what it is. And so it's kind of an appropriate metaphor. Sometimes the teacher doesn't have the decoder of the zip drive. So then they've got to find a decoder. Sometimes the teachers themselves can decode it, and then sometimes it's just given directly. So the first thing to say is that, you know, you can read a lot of books about Tibetan Buddhism, and there's a lot of it sounds kind of miraculous and amazing, and, you know, we would never run across anything like that. But lo and behold, Ajahn Rinpoche is alive and well, and he's a treasure revealer, and he's revealing treasures in the 2000s. And this treasure that he's revealed of Guru Rinpoche treasure is what we will be practicing in October. So the first thing is that, wow, I'm going to talk about kind of special delivery and personal and appropriate and relevant. You know, it's one thing to practice. I mean, all the treasures are considered very, very sacred and very, very powerful. But it's like, especially like, guess what? You know, guess what? Fresh out of the oven. This is for 2008 or whenever specifically. I don't know the exact date of this particular treasure. But this has got our name all over it. Like, for you people at this time, this is the appropriate practice. And it's also considered extremely powerful to receive a fresh treasure in a near way. And that means, you know, if you're close in time and space and relationship to the treasure revealer, it's considered particularly powerful. I'm terrible metaphor, but it's like the difference between eating the apple pie right out of the oven, or, you know, it's 3 weeks later and it's on sale, reduced because it's been sitting on the shelves for 3 weeks and it's a bit stale and it's not quite as tasty and not quite as nutritious. So when treasures are fresh and near to the treasure revealer, they're considered really, really potent. And both what we'll be doing in October and what we'll be doing in next May are treasures of that magnitude and of that kind. And it's, if you're feeling anything, you know, when we meditate, I do feel part of this is, you know, we are conduits to Ajahn Rinpoche, and he's very, very impactful Lama, guru, treasure revealer, adept. And so it's a blessing to transmit and be transparent to those blessings for our community. So the practice that we'll be doing in October is called the Realizing the Guru. So a lot of us are familiar with Guru Yoga, and this text is called something slightly different. It's called Realizing the Guru. But in many, many ways, the meaning is very, very similar. Guru Yoga. Yoga means to unite. It's cognate with the word in English, yolk, Y-O-L-K. I'm sorry, that's the egg white. Hello. Y-O-K-E. It's cognate with the yolk, which, you know, takes two oxens and combines them. So we are uniting ourselves with, when we do guru yoga, the inner nature of our teacher's true nature. And our teacher, our lineage's true nature, the teacher's teacher's true nature. So when we're doing guru yoga, we're thinking that we're typically practicing with respect to Guru Rinpoche, and his nature is the nature of all of our spiritual teachers in a body that looks like Guru Rinpoche. Guru Rinpoche is chosen because of his incredible power, his incredible realization, and really his realizations are animating through the continuity of the practices what is coming through to us, including these treasures. So the practice to make real the teacher, or realize the teacher, it's the same. It's how do we realize the inner nature, the the true nature of our teacher's realization, the deep nature, the true nature of their mind. And so there are a lot of teachings, obviously, about this in all the traditions. And if you're familiar with the teachings on Guru Yoga, that will be helpful. We'll be talking about some elements of that from here through to the October retreat. But it's not central that you will be providing the material that we think is most centrally relevant for us to be moving into that practice in October. But it's important to just hear what are the elements that will go into that practice, because again, it's a kind of a doorway into appreciating Tibetan Buddhist practice. Maybe the first and foremost element that I think it takes a really long time to fully absorb, and it's a fairly astounding doctrine, is that we are already fully enlightened. That we are already fully enlightened. Now this, if you want to read in a kind of original form where this is most clearly articulated in an Indian text, the text is called the Uttara Tantra, and you can get a very nice translation for free if you go to Dzongtsar Kenze Rinpoche's website, and you have to fill out a few forms to download it. But it's a PDF, and it's he's got actually two English translations, and his oral commentary of the Uttara Tantra, and it's a classic Indian text, and not everybody appreciates the style that these texts are written in. Frankly, I think it's a little bit more understandable and apprehendable than some of the Indian texts. It is a teaching from Maitreya, who is the Buddha to come, given to Asanga, who was one of the major Indian luminaries of Mahayana teachings in about the 300 or 400 AD. And there are five major works that Maitreya gave to Asanga, with Uttara Tantra being one of them. But within that, there is this teach, and there are a lot of debates. I mean, Tibetans love to debate. So there's a big debate about what this text means. Because it does say that we all contain the, if you like, either the womb or the embryo of the Buddha. But the debate that ensued was, is that mean full-blown, or is that mean something that's got to sort of grow and develop? And in Nyingma, which we follow, the hardline position that was taken is that full bore, it's already there. It's not like you've got to do anything to make that Buddha nature more Buddha nature. The only thing you've got to do is chip away, wash away, cleanse the stuff that's obstructing it. Now, in many, many respects, if you look at the practices that all of the groups of Tibetan Buddhists do, all of them, the practices are pretty universally the same. But the question is, I guess it would go something like this. There's a plot of land and you're pouring water, and the question is, Are you pouring water on a tree that is already full blown? Are you pouring water on a seed? And this was really hotly debated in Tibet, with the two major metaphors being one, the seed with the newest lineage of Tibetan Buddhist practice, namely the Gelugpas, going to the seed metaphor, and Nyingma and Kargyu. I'm not sure where Sakya lands, actually. They may go to the seed more, but Nyingma and Kargyu of the lineages go to your opening a little jewel box, and there's a fully formed jewel inside. You got to do nothing about the jewel. You got to get the box open. But once you open the box, the jewel is there. So practice for us is really restoring our original condition. And practices of making the teacher real, or making the guru real, or making Guru Rinpoche real, are ultimately practices for bringing us into realization of our deepest nature. Now, it is true that, you know, we'll talk on and on about this because it will hit people at different stages of their spiritual career if they're involved with this lineage. We come from a culture that worships autonomy. We come from a culture that worships independence. We come from a culture that hates dependency. We come from a culture that really downplays relationships. Downplays relationships. It's only within the last maybe 25 years that within the world of psychotherapy that the true impact of connection is being appreciated. Last 25 years. Kind of amazing. And so the language of traditional Buddhist practice associated with guru yoga and making realization of the guru, the language speaks in terms of relationship, faith, and devotion. And for scientific, engineer, lawyer, accountant, medical professional, whatever, people from our culture who have grown up to question authority and stand on their own two feet and never depend on anyone and don't be on welfare and join the Tea Party. Excuse me, I shouldn't say anything. Scratch that. Scratch it. But, you know, we have a kind of, even nowadays in the Texas legislature, there is a big deal between, I guess, Greg Abbott and like Emmett in the local, Judge Emmett in our local council of the Harris County Council, as to whether, who's going to determine which trees are protected by local communities. This is a big deal in our political climate, is like, who's got the say-so? Who's got the autonomy? You know, like, I've got the say-so on my trees because it's local county government that's got to say it, not the state government. Forget about the feds. Now the state government and the local county governments are getting into the same kinds of who's got the say-so. And so this reverberates at every layer of our culture, and certainly between us and our parents, we as adolescents, we as finding our own voice, and psychology, you know, everything we do is try to help people find their autonomous voice. And so when we're teaching a tradition which is talking about devotion and faith and lineage and blessings and union with the mind of the teacher, be surprised if something doesn't come up, which is like, what? I have to stand on my own 2 feet. What are you talking about? Union with somebody, somebody's mind. And it can create reverberations. So we just want to be aware of that. Just be aware of that. And this may have looked traditionally in traditional Tibetan Buddhist culture very different from what we aspire to in our culture. And we just have to acknowledge that. If you read books about traditional teacher-student relationships, it might stir stuff up for you. But I think maybe the takeaway for today, that I'm going to look at some stuff from Anne, is that she says this, and I think it's very, very, she's quoting Dzongsar Khyentse Rinpoche, it's not about some teacher becoming your big boss, although that might feel like what they're talking about. It's really about, how do I access my deepest nature, and can I appreciate that teachers and lineages of the teachers and have some access to this, and can I open myself up to that with some kind of open-heartedness? And can I also be aware of all the incrustations that I have even hearing that? Can I just sort of have the space, like if I find myself tensing up, okay, I notice I tense up about that. No, nothing wrong. But that there may be a way of, you know, I think for us in the West, maybe the easiest parallel entree to understanding this would be either the mind that appreciates beauty, the mind that appreciates music, the mind that appreciates art, the mind that appreciates love, the mind that appreciates young little infants. Those open-hearted times when we feel just really touched and affected by something outside of us, to the point where we can feel saturated with the impact and the meaning and the flavor of what we're perceiving. In Indian aesthetics, they actually use the word flavor, rasa. It means taste or flavor. So when people go to the theater, part of what the actors are trying to convey is an actual flavor that, if they're really good, they have it and you feel it. Now, interestingly enough, in Kashmiri Shaivism, which is a form of Indian practice, one of the greatest theoreticians of the theory of art was also one of the greatest theoreticians of their spirituality. And of all the rasas that they wrote about, one rasa, one flavor, it's called the Shanta rasa. And Shanta means peaceful. And so if an actor was really, really good at being able to convey peace, that is the Shanta rasa. And I think most of us have probably been to movies, drama, art, poetry, where people are trying to convey something. You know, we go to horror movies, they're conveying fear and terror. We get impacted by fear and terror. We go to see an inspiring movie and we walk out and we feel like, oh, I'm so inspired. Your body and your mind feels different. And maybe one of the better metaphors to really continually reflect on is that what we're doing is a spiritual theater, where we're doing something like guru yoga, or we're doing the realization of the teacher. We're engaged in an emotional and spiritual and philosophical act of attuning to the teacher's flavor.
If you enjoyed this teaching, please visit our website, donmountain.org, to subscribe to this course and find other great Dharma offerings. May all beings always have happiness in its causes. May all beings always be free of pain in its causes.